From RTE Radio, I'm Níl Óshiarthán. This is Playback Daily.
And then you have all these curious gawkers coming along who probably think this is the answer to fungi.
When we went in, there was blood everywhere. Oh, our sofas were ripped.
Connoisseurs of the high end in the gastronomic world will be very pleased to hear that banshee bones are going to be back for good.
Coming up on this edition of Playback Daily, the continuing adventures of Wally the Walrus, one woman's terrifying experience of aggravated burglary, and how to go back to school on an upcycled bicycle. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that will soon be sitting outside the principal's office thinking about what it's done. So let's begin Playback Daily where we normally do, at the coalface of the Tuberty Show Morning Musings. And today, Ryan began with some brief thoughts on Bob Ross. Who? You know, the artist guy who kind of looks like a cross between Leo Sayer and Thanos. That's him.
Do you know this guy? It's very odd to when he keeps coming up on TV every now and again. The artist Bob Ross. You know, the guy with the big hair, looks a bit like Luke Kelly. And he speaks with this really peculiar voice. But anyway, they've done a documentary on him. Apparently, it certainly sounds very, very peculiar but interesting. Bob Ross, Happy Accidents, Betrayal and Greed. You kind of want to watch that. I mean, it's kind of like a salacious documentary on Big Bird or something. You're thinking, how have they managed that? But beyond the iconic hair, we're told in entertainment.ie this morning, beyond the iconic hair, soothing voice and nostalgic paintings lies a mystery that many have yet to discover. I'm intrigued. Hopefully the documentary isn't done in just broad brushstrokes. Hey, had to do it. But I'll be watching that next Wednesday, Netflix, August 25th. Should be interesting.
From Bob to Bond, leaving his kids hanging in the breeze.
Daniel Craig was giving an interview and he said that he was quoting Andrew Carnegie, who you'll know from your library or wherever it might be, or Carnegie Halls. And he was saying that Andrew Carnegie gave away what in today's money would amount to $11 billion. I don't know how he amassed such a fortune, but he did. But he gave it all away, most of it. And he said that he plans on doing the same. He's made millions as James Bond. And someday, within the next decade, the new James Bond film will land. But we've been waiting, as Bond fans will know, waiting and waiting and waiting. The trailer looks just so exciting. And But hopefully, I think it's April, it keeps getting pushed out the whole time. And on it goes. He said that he is going to not really leave them any substantial inheritance because he finds the practice distasteful. I'm sure his kids will be delighted to hear that. Yeah, you're right, Dad. It's really distasteful. But he's saying no. He has a three-year-old daughter and a stepson with his, what they describe here as his current wife, if you don't mind. That's a very pessimistic outlook on the whole thing, isn't it? The very beautiful Rachel Weisz and an adult daughter called Ella, that's a grand name, with his ex-wife Fiona Luden. So off he goes with all his money and he's going to give it all away to his kids watching through the window as he throws it at different charities going, no, that was my boat, that was my house, that was my new outfit. Gone. Gone for a good cause, so don't cry. He's doing the right thing.
From a certain perspective, indeed he is. This next excerpt from the Tubbs Stream of Consciousness carries a film snob warning.
Fast and Furious 10 gets a release date. 10 films? Are you kidding? Because they did F9, and which I thought was a movie about a keyboard, but actually it's just an abbreviation of Fast and Furious 9. But they've got the 10th one, isn't it? they have a release date for that now. The movie grossed $681.5 million at the box office and is the third highest grossing movie of the year, that is to say F9, after Hi Mom and Detective Chinatown 3. What are these films? Who's going to see them? What is F9 anyway? F9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, they're all going great guns at the box office. So I don't know who watches them or what they're about or what they do. Maybe I should sit through one. But I'm not sure if they're my bag, as it were.
Almost certainly not. But no harm in trying all the same, right? In other news,
another Irish novel is going to be realised as a TV programme. This time it is Exciting Times by Nisha Dolan. Ava is the main character in there, a Dublin girl, woman who moves to Hong Kong to work as a teacher, ends up dating two very different people. There's the banker Julian and the straight talker Edith. And that is a novel that did very well when it came out, and now it's going to be a film or a TV show, but describe a TV adaptation. But we'll be starring the Bridgerton breakout star, Phoebe Dynevor. So that will be interesting for good casting, by the way, because I've read the book and she looks like she's a good fit for that, as far as I'm concerned. Connoisseurs of the high end in the gastronomic world will be very pleased to hear that Banshee Bones are going to be back for good. They're staying at, they're getting the full Take That treatment. They're back for good. Tato Banshee Bones. They think they sent them out for a little while just to see, do you want them or not? Like the orange twirl, which I love, or the anything orangey or minty is good. But the Banshee Bones, I think I had a packet when they came in. They're radioactive, and they're kind of grotesquely delicious. Would that be a fair way of putting it? It reminds me, you know, the spoof band, they were the Beatles, but they called themselves the Ruttles, and it was just a take on the Beatles. And they did a song called Cheese and Onion, which I always think is kind of like a tribute, really, to the great Irish crisp, Cheese and Onion. And what they've done is, I have it here actually, what they've done really, they've taken a bit of a John Lennon tribute voice. If you can imagine John writing about his favourite crisps with the Beatles, this is how it would go. You got the idea. You can look it up. It's just a magnificent Beatles-y tribute to Cheese and Onion. And why wouldn't it?
Yeah, I'm still none the wiser on Banshee Bones, though. Are they Cheese and Onion or what? What actually are they? I'm intrigued and repulsed at the same time. And that's a pretty good place to conclude the newsings for today and try to move on with our lives. Monaghan under 20 captain Brendan Ogie O'Duffig died in a car accident last month. He was just 19 years of age. Ogie's Month's Mind Mass takes place on Saturday, and Ogie's father, Brendan Sr., joined Philip Boucher Hayes in studio this morning.
Brendan, you said something that I think is going to resonate with a huge number of people who have buried a loved one. You said that it wasn't really until the funeral that we got to know Ogie. What's it like seeing your own son through other people's eyes?
Well, I suppose the relationship between parents and their children change as the children get older, and maybe teenagers don't share everything with their parents, and that would have been true in the case of Ogie. We didn't really know him properly, as you say, until his death. During the wake at her home, we heard so many stories from so many people of his acts of kindness to others. And that has been very comforting to us, and it has left us very proud. He was given lifts home to friends after parties, helping friends with mental health issues, coming to the aid of a peer who was assaulted on the street one weekend night, and also repairing friends' cars. We weren't aware of any of this. He certainly didn't do it to get any brownie points with his parents. But these stories that were recalled to us repeatedly at the wake house, they certainly will remain with us.
You must also have seen, and I don't know, were you aware of this while he was alive, the extent to which he was a leader to so many of his peers and how people flocked to him?
Well, probably when he was appointed or selected as the team captain in the under-17 team in 2018, we became aware of it then. No, we weren't aware of it. We might be very humble. I wouldn't be the best at reading a football game. Maybe I didn't appreciate his attributes properly. Certainly Seamus Banty McEnany did. Leaving the football a little bit, I suppose we recognised that he was energetic, that he was good-natured, that he was friendly and popular. But having said that, I wouldn't want to depict him as a saint or an angel, because he certainly wasn't. He was bold, he could be cheeky. But I suppose I'm happy that we didn't rear an angel. And he was very intelligent, but not very academic at school, even though he did enjoy the practical subjects like engineering and woodwork. And he had loads of hobbies as he grew up. He had hens. I bought him 12 hens up in Broomfield on one occasion, Rhode Island Reds and Silkies and Marns. And he entered these hens, and indeed his dog Twix, in local agricultural shows, into Davenant and Castleblaney and Carrick Row, winning a few rosettes on the way. He fished for one summer for a pike and perch in the local lakes. He visited Ranafast with the family. That's the Gaeltacht there in northwest Donegal, which is like a second home to me. Indeed, it is a second home to me, and he would have been swimming in Carrickfinn Beach and climbing Errigal Mountain and kayaking around Critch Island, etc.
Yeah, I'm not playing down his animal husbandry skills for one moment, but it won't be for raising hens that he's remembered. It will be for captaining that team. What was it like for you as his dad, seeing him lead out the team for the first time?
So it was a very, very proud occasion, really, you know. It's something that will resonate with me always in my life. I suppose he started playing soccer initially when he was 5 or 6 years of age, attending the Coach Barry Academy for a year.
He kind of dabbled with everything, didn't he?
He did, and then he joined the Harps Gaelic Football Club, and I'd like to say a few words about them maybe later on, if I may. But he played basketball for the local Blackwater Steelers, winning an under 14 medal, national medal, I'm not too sure at what grade. He swam competitively with the local Slieve Bay Swimming Club. He also was interested in boxing and gymnastics and rugby, but there simply weren't enough hours in the day to bring into all these additional sports, you know.
And how are you at this stage with talking about the events on the day of the crash?
I suppose coming in here this morning, I've tried to remove myself from it, if you like. Of course, they were very lonely. There's an overwhelming sense of numbness and emptiness, and that will remain with us. But I've to park those emotions and those feelings for this interview.
Well, okay, for the interview, but you can't park those emotions all the time.
No, and I don't wish to do so. I suppose one of the reasons I came in here was that maybe it will help some other parent in a similar position who has lost a teenager. We've got letters from throughout the country, many people we don't know who either have teenagers playing football and thinking of their own children, or indeed some who have had major tragedies themselves. No, I wouldn't be suppressing my emotions or feelings, quite the opposite. I'm only really a minute away from weeping at any moment now, really. Yeah. I speak to a lot of people, my friends have been great listening to me, and I feel that that will carry me through and help me in the weeks and months and years ahead.
A call like the one that you received is none that you would never ever expect, Brendan, but this must have been such a bolt from the blue, because it was just an hour and a half after a match.
That's correct. Oakie was playing in Brewster Park Enniskillen at 9:30, and he was dead 2 hours later. And I suppose the euphoria from winning the match to the devastation of his death added to that shock for us, and indeed the broader GAA community and the County Monaghan community. The emergency services were on the scene of the accident within minutes, and they did everything that they could to save Ogie's life. And my older daughter Claire and I got a call, and we were out at the scene pretty fast.
And when you got that call, you initially started discussing the match, because obviously, you know, this was not where your mind was running.
Yeah, it was Tony Graham, one of the mentors of the team, that phoned me, and I talked about the second half turnaround in the match, because Monaghan had been doing pretty poorly in the first half, and he cut me off and said, "I'm not on the phone to talk to you about the match, but Ogie was in an accident." I called Claire. We went out to the scene. On the way out, we discussed it. Had he a broken leg or two broken legs? But we never dreamt that his life might be in peril or that he would be dead. We saw him sitting up in the car with a paramedic holding his head up straight. He looked peaceful. He was unconscious. He was possibly dead. But I didn't take that in. I'm not sure if that was shock or denial or a combination of both. I spoke to him in Irish. I said, "Ogie, Daddy and Shaw, will to Carcalior, Ogie." And
Did he respond?
He didn't, no.
Was he able to look you in the eye?
No. He was possibly dead at that stage, but I didn't recognise that. I didn't understand that. I was pulled away from the scene by the services as they removed his body from the car. I felt useless, that there was nothing I could do or that I couldn't make any...
But you were there, Brendan. I'm sure that must have been solace or a satisfaction.
It certainly was, that our presence was there, that we, you know, and there's no doubt about that. I'm delighted that I was there, even though it was quite harrowing. Everything at that moment depended on the expertise of the professionals, but alas, it wasn't to be. My memories of that particular passage of time is quite hazy. Claire's recollection, my daughter's recollection, would appear to me more accurate, you know. And maybe an hour later, they were working on him on the side of the road for possibly an hour. A sergeant approached me. She sat me down on the side of the road with Canon Paddy McGinn at my side, and she said to me, "I'm sorry," and that was enough. I knew Ogie was dead. It was the most horrible, horrible moment of my life to be told that my 19-year-old son, my only son, was dead. Shortly afterwards, then, I was led into an ambulance where I had to formally identify his body. Again, that was difficult to articulate. I had to say that I confirmed that this is the body of my son, Ogie. Then we had to rush home because my younger daughter, Anya, was there. Now, we had ensured that she had friends in the house that, in the meantime, but we wanted to get her to her to tell her what had happened before she saw it on social media. Immediately after the match, Ogie had sent Anya a sound file asking him or asking her to get a snack box in the local takeaway. And of course, that snack box remained uneaten on the kitchen table for a few days.
Oh, God. Oh, Lord. You had to make a phone call that I could never, ever imagine having the guts to call his mother, your wife, Esther, who was on a pilgrimage in Medjugorje at the time,
was
it?
That's correct. I had called her once or twice and told her that there was an accident in the second call, that it was quite serious. And then in the third call, she had flown out to Medjugorje 2 days earlier with a group from County Armagh. I phoned her and somebody asked me, "Well, how did you sugarcoat that?" There was no sugarcoating on it. I had very little left in the battery in the phone, and it was one or two sentences really. And I told her the dreadful news, and she replied, "Wasn't it marvellous that we had 19 wonderful years with him?" And that was, I think, one of the quotations in one of the Sunday newspapers.
And Brendan, is that literally the first thing that she said in that, response to you?
Quote unquote, that is what she said. I couldn't believe her response, as I had screamed and cried until my jaw got sore and I had no energy left within me to emit any sound. She is very religious, and this remains her great support in dealing with Ogie's death.
At the end of the interview, Philip played a collection of tributes to Ogie that the programme team had assembled.
There was always a little bit of devilment with Ogie. Look, he was the centre of any crack that was going on. He had a lovely smile that made you feel genuinely glad to meet him. More than that, Ogie was a wonderful young man who added a little to every life that he touched. Look, we all feel very privileged to be part of his life. Something that we would have noticed from a very young age, that his teammates naturally gravitated towards him. I've never seen it before, and I don't think I'll ever see it again. He was a born leader. Not a man for big, extravagant speeches or thumping tables, but when he led, others followed.
It was just typical of his character and how he played football. Was just with heart, with determination, with passion and leadership. Any time I would have met him, you could tell and you could understand why he was such a good leader and so well respected both on and off the field.
For me personally, it was very difficult because I managed this young fella and he was my captain in the minor team, and you know, what comes, only those that has been in a manager's position with a captain understands the trust is there, the loyalty is there, the love is there. This man had a huge future in front of his man in football. He was a brilliant leader. I'll tell you a short story. I let the players pick the captain of my minor team in 2017 or 18, whenever 18. And there's 30-man panel, 24 players voted for Ogie Duffy to be a captain. That's the type of a fella he was.
You can only feel that the Monaghan players are playing for something a bit bigger here, Adrian, you know, and it puts football into perspective sometimes, that there's a bit more to life, you know, than we all think.
A guard of honour was formed by Monaghan Harps at the family home, later joined by members of the Monaghan senior football team, and then arriving in unison to complete the guard, the Monaghan under 20 team, his teammates on Friday evening before that tragic accident, all wearing their Monaghan jerseys and tracksuits, all with the numbers on the back, but of course with one missing, number 6 for Brendan Oag.
Cadas Fadalina Rodan, the Tish Mahori, Brendan Oag Zesser, a Draforica, Claire Agazonia. Then the lads are in Furin Fui Fihe. It's the club, Monaghan Harps, Ogs the Cordia, Ni Doylem Gwil na Fuck Alown. Ogokthin air in Sunday game, on Furin Sport in RTE, Ogs Gundout, our son Wheater coming Luke Lascale or Fidna Thira, Covrono Cree. Our yesh day, Grau Anam Dealish.
RTE presenter Des Cahill ending a collection of tributes to the Monaghan under 20 captain Ogie O'Duffy, who died in a car crash last month. Philip Boucher-Hayes played the tributes for Ogie's father Brendan on the Today programme this morning. Now, a terrifying story of a break-in and assault opened this afternoon's Liveline. Trish, not her real name, was the victim of an aggravated burglary at her home in Finglas last week. Joe Duffy spoke first to Trish's friend, Anne, also not her real name, who told him what she knows about the ordeal Trish went through.
And how many of them broke into the house?
She reckons probably three or four. She was a bit confused because when she came around, she remembers them talking to her and demanding stuff from wherever. She said she thought it was a dream when they were ordinary. They did hold a gun to her head. Now, the imprint of the gun was left on the side of her head.
My God.
They hit her on the top of the head. She had to get staples on her head.
My God.
Now, when it all up, she doesn't even remember how long this was going on. They ransacked the home. The kids off the road would go into her and she'd sit for hours talking to them. Like, that was her life, all the kids on the road. Now, it was only the kids then came out and they were ringing us and saying, oh, you'll have to do something. You want it? Like, she can't live in that house. So we went over, myself and some of the neighbours went into her. Now, when we seen it, we really got an awful fright. So we sort of just walked back out.
And what was it like? They'd wrecked the house, wasn't it?
They wrecked it. They ransacked it. You know what? I never seen that like it in my life. It was like something off a movie. When we went in, there was blood everywhere.
Oh,
our sofas were ripped. The kitchen was wrecked. Everything was pulled out. There was chairs were broken. There was our beds were ripped. They ransacked it. They were looking. I don't know whatever they were looking for, but they ripped. They put holes in our wall up in the youngster's bedroom. There was a little hole in the wall, but they put holes in the wall. And anyways.
Okay.
And Trish, like, there was no need for it.
Oh my God! And the Gardaí, as the Gardaí are saying, is a case of
mistaken
identity.
Yeah.
Trish is there beside you. I know she's still distressed. Trish, Joe here. How are you today?
I'm okay. I'm just a bit panicked.
Yeah, it's a week now since it happened. What were you doing? You were sitting watching telly on Thursday evening.
Yeah, I was sitting watching the telly. I was on my own, and thank God my kids weren't with me because they're usually always there.
Okay.
And if somebody knocked at the door, I can't remember what time it was, but from the police, what they told me was about 11:30.
Okay.
Between 11:30 and about 10 to 12.
Okay.
And when somebody rings me bell, I just open the window at night, you know, because I won't open the hall door because I'm nervous as it is anyway. You know, I'm just a nervous person. And my kids would just obviously walk in, so I knew it wasn't them. So when I opened the window, so it was a figure like leaning over my gas box, like hunched down.
Okay.
And me thinking it was me door, or a jacket up, like, you know.
Yeah, messing.
I was calling her, and then I heard a male voice saying something, I don't know what they said. And I closed the window thinking it was me son then, and pulling a prank on me with his friends after coming back from the gym. But when I closed the window, I went to open the hall door, and I thought it was them coming in again, and when the two fellas came in, and one of them punched me to the floor.
Oh,
and I fell, like, just beside the fireplace. And then they just repeatedly hit me on the head with a gun, pointed the gun to my head, kept asking me, where's the money? Mm. I kept shouting my name, saying, I think you have the wrong house. Like, you must have the wrong house. I've no money here. And they kept saying, look, yeah, we're going to murder you, like, if you don't give us the money, like. And I was like, there's money in my purse. I said, take the money in my purse. And I said, I think I had €100 in my purse, and there was €70 on the mantelpiece belonging to me daughter.
Yeah.
So they took the money from my purse. They threw my purse at me and asked me to open and find the money. And I opened it and gave it to them, and they took that, and I could see out of me eye, like, that they were ripping me sofas. One of them, one was standing over me all the time, like hovering over me, and he was there. He was like just saying horrible, calling me horrible names, and, you know, kicking me on the back and kicking me on the legs. And he kept saying to me, if you're on your own here, nobody knows you're here, so don't swim and shut your mouth, and putting his hand over me mouth with his gloves on and covering me and stopping me breathing. And then I just kept looking at a candle that had lighting on the mantelpiece for me auntie who passed away, and I kept just praying that if anybody was to find me, I hope my family wouldn't find me, you know.
So at this stage, Trish, how many men are in the house?
I reckon about three, because there was one over me.
Yeah.
I think there was one in the kitchen, and I'm nearly sure there was a clear noise upstairs.
And were their faces covered? I presume they were.
Yeah, they had like scarves over their faces with black hoods on them, the track tops or whatever.
And did you? What age? Were they big lads or small lads?
I was lying down, so they looked like tall to me, and I couldn't really I couldn't look up. Every time I looked up, my face was pushed back into the blood, and they were throwing clothes over my head like.
Did you know at that stage that they were going through the whole house, wrecking it?
I could hear noises. Like I was aware of noise everywhere, and my little dog was in the house as well, and she was running up the stairs, so I knew she was chasing them everywhere, you know. And I could hear them shouting at the dog, like, and saying they were going to kill the dog as well,
Of course she hasn't. What's your dog called?
Sasha.
Sasha. Fair play, Sasha. That's, so you're still on the floor, and what, they put a gun to your head?
So they put the gun to me, the front of my head and the side of me. I have two marks on my temple where they held the gun to my head like twice on two different occasions. And when they hit me on the head with the gun as well, they busted my head open. I have staples in my head.
Savage.
I was in the hospital, obviously, and my bruises all over me, all over my back and my arms and my legs and, my stomach.
And did they say anything else?
They were just saying, give us the money. And I was like,
but you're saying, I've no money. What are you on about? I've no money.
Yeah. That's what I said. I kept shouting out my name. Yeah. And then I was kept saying my number and my house, my address. And I was like, you haven't got the right house. This has to be the wrong house, because I do nothing on nobody.
Yeah, I know you don't. I know you're very good. All your neighbours contacted us. You are very good, and very good to the neighbours, and their children have been for years. And Trish, how did it end?
I just all of a sudden, I heard silence, and I heard the door opening, and then I heard silence. And when I heard the silence, I just kind of start talking to myself, saying, "Julian, you have to get up off the floor. Trish, you have to get up off the floor." And I got up and talked myself off the floor, and I just said, I got up and reached up to me shelf where me phone was, and I just rang 999.
Yeah.
And the police were out in 2 minutes, 3 minutes.
Brilliant.
That's Trish, not her real name, telling Joe Duffy on this afternoon's Liveline about the horrific aggravated burglary she was subjected to in her own home last week. On Monday's Ryan Tuberty Show, the subject of bystander intervention, particularly when it comes to instances of domestic abuse, was discussed. And this morning, Ryan returned to the subject to read a selection of responses from listeners.
Comments like this one. I was coming out of Peakers in Dunleary about 25 years ago at 2 o'clock in the morning, and I saw a small car in front of me and it was shaking. And for a while I thought it might be an amorous couple, as the windows were a little foggy. But as I passed by, I heard and saw a guy belting a girl in the front seat, and he was belting her repeatedly. I ran to the driver's door. I pulled him out onto the ground. And within a minute, somebody jumped on my back, screeching and scratching. And that was the victim. She had jumped around the other side of the car to get you off of him. And that was the last time, says Derek, that I ever intervened in a domestic dispute. Another said, my now husband, having dropped me home one night, saw a man physically assaulting his partner. He pulled over, the engine running, and he went over to assist her. He was punched in the face and his car door was kicked in. Instinct directs us to act, but it's hard to predict outcome. As a female, I would have reacted exactly the same way. Regarding the dilemma you mentioned in conflict, reminded me of, it says, a text of the remarkable public response, which I've actually done before, so we'll keep going on to the next one, which says, I was in an abusive relationship for a few years, and there was a final physical assault at the end. The only reason I escaped was because two sets of neighbours upstairs and next door heard my shouts for help. They came and banged on the door. and they called my name. And when I heard them, I was somehow able to get free and run to the door to open it. The neighbours helped me. They encouraged me to call the Gardaí and stayed with me until they came. They also got the person who did it out of my house. And I honestly don't know what would have happened if they hadn't intervened. I know it can be scary, but as someone who has been through it, please always intervene. Another from Margaret: tell people to quietly or calmly intervene to help someone at risk, but make sure not to endanger oneself. Just try to diffuse the situation. Don't ask any questions. And one more, slightly lengthier one, but it is an email. I live in a neighbourhood in South County Dublin, says this person, and during the lockdown last November, I saw a frightening scene unfold in our neighbourhood one evening. The Gardaí spent a lot of time trying to gain access to a house, and at the time I knew a woman and her small children lived there. After a long time banging the door down, the male, who was her partner, came out and was arrested by Gardaí. Anyway, the following day I felt so upset, went to the supermarket, bought a load of groceries to bring to the house. I dropped them to her doorstep with a note letting her know that we've never met or spoken, but if she needed any help, she could ring our doorbell. As I was leaving, she came to the front door, and so she stepped outside and we spoke briefly beyond earshot from her children. I had never spoken to her before. I've seen her on the road because her kids play out on the same road as mine do, but she told me she was in pain and was glad she had the courage to phone the Gardaí. In the moment I was talking to her, she was scared that her partner was due home any minute. She was aware the Gardaí couldn't keep him away from his own home until she herself went and obtained a court barring order. And immediately I ran into my own house. I rang Women's Aid. I wrote down as much information as I could to share with my neighbour. I was frightened myself of ringing her door again to give her the information in case her partner returned from the Garda station, and I didn't want him to see me helping her in case it made the situation worse. Anyway, for 2 or 3 days after that, I continued to pop notes in her door. We spoke outside for her house, rather. Each time she felt comfortable doing so, I encouraged her to contact her sister or family who live in another country. But my heart still breaks for the awful situation she had been in for a long time before she became able to ring the Gardaí for help. And that's a very small flavour of the kind of thing that came in on the subject about intervention. We may go there a little later on further on that from somebody who knows more on from a professional point of view. But that's, as I say, a drop in the ocean of what people have seen and heard, and the terror that that stalks the country in certain houses that become essentially awful, awful prisons for some people.
Chilling insights into domestic abuse from some people who decided intervention was better than standing by on this morning's Ryan Tuberty Show. On Tuesday's Playback Daily, we heard from Seal Watch Ireland's Melanie Crosay talking to Catherine Thomas on the Ryan Tuberty Show about the adventures of Wally the Walrus off the southwest coast. Well, this morning Melanie turned up on the Today programme as Philip Boucher-Hayes brought us the news that a floating sea couch is planned to enable Wally the Walrus to kick back and enjoy his surroundings without having to climb onto people's boats. Philip spoke to Melanie, as well as environmentalist and Mooney Goes Wild regular Annie Launa, about the trouble with Wally. First, Melanie explained how the sea couch idea came together.
Well, the original idea was given to us by the Marine Life Rescue in UK that had put together some pontoons in a formation for the walrus to lay on as sort of a designated haul-out site in the Isle of Scilly. And that did work for them well, and he stayed there for a number of weeks before moving on and showing up on our coastline in Waterford about 2 weeks ago. So since then, he's sort of just climbed on anything he can, ribs, boats. He has caused a bit of damage. He sunk a few boats. And so in communications with them, we decided to try to do the same thing. Now, the problem is he's moving quickly across the coastline, and these pontoons are sort of hard to come by, and they're hard to transport. So it hasn't really been that practical. By the time we get a pontoon organized for him, he's already moved on to the next location.
Huh. And if you did manage to get it into the right place, what would you do to try and encourage him to use it rather than a boat?
Well, at this point, we've got a rib that's designated for him, which is even better because a rib can easily be relocated to another spot. So there is a rib out for him now. And what they did earlier and what we were putting into practice is he likes his own scent. So if you can get like a towel or something and you can put it in one of the boats that he's been resting in, then you put that scent onto the designated rib and hopefully he will relocate to that one. But he's, you know, he's a wild animal. He's unpredictable. And he's, yeah, we can't really communicate with him. This is your rib. Please don't get on the other one. So at the moment, we're kind of just learning by doing. But, you know, it's just the best thing to do is to just keep reminding people to please, this is a wild animal and he's not here for entertainment. He's just trying to survive and he's been displaced from his Arctic habitat. We hope that he makes his way back up there. But the only way he'll be able to do that is if we respect him from a distance of at least 100 meters. Do not approach him. Try not to make noises. Just let him rest so he can gather up enough energy to keep moving.
And is it the case that he possibly has injured himself climbing in and out of these boats?
Yeah, it is. There's been a number of cases where there's been sort of little superficial injuries observed. There has been mention of a potential injury on one of his flippers from yesterday. And that's just because the boat that he was resting on, boat owner said that, you know, there's sharp objects inside the boat. And because he was repeatedly being approached and circled by boats and kayakers and paddleboards, he would get disturbed and he would go into the water and then back in the boat repeatedly. So that increases the likelihood of him getting injured. Also, it increases the likelihood of damage to the boat. So the designated rib would really solve all these problems as long as people just cooperate and respect him from the distance, which most people are. Most people are very excited to see him, and they know that, you know, what's best for him is to just let him rest and observe him from afar. But it only takes a handful of people to disrupt that and to approach him. And that's what's been happening. So we're just asking that people please not share his location, because that's what's attracting the crowds. And to just keep in mind that he's very tired. He's alone. He's just a juvenile. He's about 4 to 5 years old. But he's very, very large. So he could do damage if people get close. So it's just important for everyone involved to remember to maintain a safe distance from wildlife, and that includes our native seals as well.
Ian and Ilona, you would think that a little bit of common sense wouldn't be a bad idea here. Would you go anywhere near a possibly injured, almost certainly stressed and agitated walrus?
You know, Philip, common sense is not really all that common, is it indeed? No, of course I wouldn't. This is a wild animal. This is an animal that we have caused to be like this. This walrus feeds on clams. He has to dive down. He has to get clams. That's what he feeds on, shellfish. And then he hauls out on the permanent ice to rest. Now, in 1981, we had 7 million square kilometres of permanent ice in the Arctic region where he comes from. And now we have less than 4 million. We've nearly halved the amount of permanent ice. And it's breaking off all the time. And poor old Wally floated off on a big lump of ice, they assume, which finally melted, putting paid to anywhere that he can haul out. So for all of the generations of walruses, they've always had something permanent to haul out on when they're finished diving for clams and come back up again. They're mammals. They have to hold their breath and dive, and they're good at it. But still, they need to rest afterwards. And there's no permanent ice. Now, he lives in the Arctic where there are no people, and he's not used to people. He thinks boats are bits of ice, God love him. And then you have all these curious gawkers coming along who probably think this is the answer to fungi. This is a walrus. This is a thing that's 800 kilograms in weight, bigger than a bull, bigger than a cow. I mean, if you wouldn't go into a field with a strange bull and start getting your picture taken, although I suppose some people would. But it's so unfair. It's so unfair to the walrus because something will happen, because somebody's going to fall out of a boat or something is going to happen. And then the poor wild animal, whose fault it is not, it's our fault for him being here in the first instance, is going to suffer from the stupidity of people. So no, I wouldn't go. I might be on land maybe with my telescope or something, the way you look at it, other things that are in the sea, but going up in a boat and whirling around in a kayak is lunacy, and it's so mean and so unfair to the walrus.
Ain and Ilona talking, along with Melanie Crosay, to Philip Boucher-Hayes on this morning's Today programme about efforts to support Wally the Walrus. Where, you might be wondering, although frankly I'd be surprised if you were, is the novelist Anthony Horowitz? Ryan Tuberty sent his crack team to locate the elusive author of James Bond and many other novels, and he spoke to Ryan this morning from...
And I'm actually in the middle of the Aegean Sea at the moment on a rather rickety ferry heading towards the island of Milos, I'm going to have a week of rest after having worked very, very hard. I don't know whether to be slightly ashamed of having taken a holiday or whether I'm quite pleased with myself, but that is where I am.
I didn't think you had any Irish in you, but that's the most Irish description of taking a holiday. In other words, you're apologising for enjoying yourself. Are you a Catholic?
Well, you know, Ryan, it's been such a terrible year for everybody that I think with the time, it's sort of a little bit, it is a little bit selfish, and I'm aware of that. And I only went with a certain amount of misgivings, but you know, yeah. I have worked hard, and as I said, I finished a book, so here I am. I have to mention, even if the signal goes,
I understand why.
But the interview was not to be, because apparently there's a Russian spy ship off the coast of Ireland that doesn't want us to hear what Anthony Horowitz has to say.
It's a heartbreak. Okay, look, what we'll do is we'll just park Anthony and admit defeat on that. We got the high. Do you know what it was? It's because I was slagging the boat, yeah, the Russian spies. It's Poseidon. He's taken the Poseidon out of me because I obviously, or Neptune, probably a bit more polite, is having a pop. But there's no point in dragging the proverbial out of that because it wouldn't be fair on everyone. So look, when Anthony gets to a landline in due course and can afford us the time, we'll go and talk to him.
But how to fill the remaining time on the Ryan Tuberty Show this morning? Just what do you do when your main interviewee is rendered uninterviewable and it's only 9:30? Well, if you're Ryan Tuberty, you start by turning to the listeners.
David emails to say, "Dear Ryan, my name is David, okay? Stop me if you don't play Radio Quest." Okay, stop. Elsewhere, 515, don't joke. The odd time. "It's my birthday today. Congratulations. And, well, I'm 38. Perfect age, full of wisdom, full of life, and no girlfriend. LOL. But I was thinking that in 65 years from now, when I'll be 102, I'd like to say to myself, don't change anything about yourself. You are doing just perfectly. Lots of love from the future me, David." David, I like your style. You're as daft, but I like your style. Happy birthday. There he goes. David, 38. Can't find a woman. Okay, good luck with that.
Then you play some music. It's coming, trust me.
And meanwhile, I went to see a film called, I mentioned it, Free Guy. It was a case of there's nothing else on, and it was that time. So I just said, actually, we'll chance it. And it was good. It was a bit off the beaten track. I mentioned it earlier. It stars Ryan Reynolds and the Killing Eve, Jodie Comer. And it's grand. It's probably for teenagers more than for grown. Or it's kind of Deadpool. Like, which I thought was very funny. So, big kids, that kind of thing. But those of you who like to stroke your cheek, your cheek or your chin, rather, and with a pointy head, you're going to hate it. Don't go to the, like, go and see Stillwater, you'll be grand. And in that film, they keep playing this song that I'm going to play now. Not quite sure why, but maybe to celebrate her Irish roots, and she's launched a booze strand of some sort. And here it is. Mariah.
Okay, then what do you do? Well, what about talking to Owen, a man who's interested in timber with a story?
If anyone had some old timber in any kind of volume, I'd be delighted. I would love to hear from them.
Okay, but the key is, as you say, you're not looking for Auntie Mary's cabinet out the back.
No.
That's a bit of wood. That's for the fire,
right.
Or that's for an upcycle.
Exactly, but we're not looking for, I have a few planks out in the shed that Uncle Tommy left out there.
Okay, so what you are looking for, can you be a bit more specific in terms of what would you love?
I would love if someone has some timber that they know where it came from.
Okay.
For example, like I just got some lovely timber from an old church. That kind of stuff. A lot of people, you see, the demolitions will pull down these pieces, and a lot of it just goes to landfill or skips. But I'm looking for timber with a story.
Yeah. Okay. Timber with a story. I like that. And do you include a sort of provenance when you sell one of these, or how does that work?
Oh yeah, they all have a little card, and they tell you exactly where that piece of timber came from and how old it is. Generally, I even know how old most of them are.
Okay.
And yeah, no, they're all individually labelled, and we work with lovely old railway sleepers, and in those,
lovely.
You find all sorts of madness in those. You know where they've cut the. We've even had an arrowhead in an old piece of timber at one stage many years ago.
Okay.
So it's all kinds of everything.
I got a lovely gift, and it's upstairs on my desk actually, from Pete Brennan, our dear old friend from Beatles Ireland. And it was a little piece of the of wood with a little plaque on it to say, this is a tiny bit of the stage on the the Abbey where the Beatles played when they came to Ireland.
Wow.
Isn't that lovely? I should give that to you to make it into a lamp or something.
I do. Oh, I'd love to even just see it.
The Adelphi, sorry, not the Abbey.
Make that into a lamp in for your eye.
Well, I mean, look, I'm not looking for anything. But I wonder what you could do with it. It's like the size of it's about half an A4 page. Like, it's a simple piece of wood.
Send me on a photo and I'll have a thinky.
Okay, because that's quality provenance there, isn't it?
Oh, it is. That's fantastic.
I just wouldn't know. I don't know. I haven't known what to do with it other than just put it there.
Oh, send me a photo. I'd love to even see it. Send me a photo.
Okay.
I'd love to think.
So there are buildings all around the country with great stories from the famine, from the War of Independence in 1916. It could be the sadder story. It could be Magdalen Laundry even. You'll take it all.
And I'm looking for old roof beams and barn. I get some beautiful, in the days when we had lots of oak in this country, we used to use it for roof beams and barns. But those days are long gone, but some of those timbers are extraordinary. They've been there for hundreds and hundreds of years.
I love your passion because, anyone else would just see a few planks of wood and go, get rid of those. No. You're looking to go, where do we come from?
Oh, sacrilegious.
Owen Shanley from Copperfish Lighting, stepping into an Anthony Horowitz-shaped hole on this morning's Ryan Tuberty Show. Nice save. And if you've got something you think Owen might be interested in, you can contact him through his website, copperfish.ie. Today with Clare Byrne reporter Evelyn O'Rourke brought us the first in a series of back-to-school reports on this morning's programme. She told Philip Outre-Hayes about a special delivery for one school in South Dublin.
Well, this story actually starts at the Bike Hub in Dunleary, which is a great spot. It's a kind of a social enterprise where people can get their bikes repaired or upcycled. And there's a special area just opposite the Ornelai building there at the harbour. And they've launched as part of their work many of the things they're doing, but part of it is this back to school project where their plan is to deliver as many bikes as possible to students. So what they're asking is that people are invited to donate their old bikes, right? Then a team of volunteers fix them up and then those recycled bikes are delivered to students in need in secondary schools at schools, for example. Now, I went out there during the week and the bike hub was buzzing because they were preparing to deliver 5 repaired bikes to St. Lawrence's College in Loughlinstown. So what they do is they fix up the bikes and then with the donations and the different work that they do, they also try to provide helmets, locks and bells for the bikes at a cost of roughly €75 covered by donations and their commercial work. And I started by visiting Stephen McManus, one of the founders of the bike hub, and I also spoke to Brona Carey, who has come on board with them to coordinate things.
Hello, welcome to the Bike Hub. We are in Dunleary at the edge of the East Pier in front of Dunleary and also in front of the Lexicon.
So tell me about this work then, the Bike Hub. You're a cyclist, obviously.
Oh, I sure am. According to my mother, since I was 3 years old, I've been crazy about bicycles. I think there's a lot of abandoned bikes that, could do with new loving owners. Looking at retired people, people on low income, students in Dash schools and so on. So, yes, there's a lot of people coming with very, very nice bicycles. We're looking for the right end users for them. Some of them require very little work. Some of them require a lot of work. It's great that we have a good team of volunteers.
Roughly, how long does it take you to upcycle them and get them roadworthy?
A bicycle could take 3-4 hours of work. The biggest challenge sometimes is to find spare parts. There's a major shortage at the moment, so that's a big issue.
Tell me finally then, what does it mean to you to hand these bikes over to, say, the school children at Desh School?
It's a great feeling. You go to sleep happier. You wake up happier. It's a great thing to do.
My name is Brona Carey and I am the coordinator of Bike Hub. I'm a volunteer. So we try to get bikes that might be left in your shed and then bring them in, and the guys here upcycle them, do them up a bit, and then I coordinate them to go back out to Dash schools, the refugee council, people who are in need of them. So people who are going back to school at the moment, anybody who doesn't have a bike and is in need of a bike and is in a Dash school, that kind of area, we try to get them back out to them. So it's a bit of coordination involved between the principals and the drivers and the mechanics to get them up and running. We don't really want bikes that I've been left out in your back garden for weeks on end and it's all rusty. So any primary school kids, any secondary school, and then in the refugee council we have adults. So all shapes and sizes except for tiny trikes and in fairly good condition, but it doesn't have to be perfect.
Once the bikes are collected, the volunteers get to work on making them roadworthy.
When I was there, I spoke to some of the volunteers who were busy fixing up the bikes, and I start with Pork. And then we'll hear from Dennis O'Reilly, who is one of the founders of another initiative, the Good Grub Food Delivery Charity for Deish Schools. And Dennis was actually there in Dunleary because he was helping to load up the five bikes for St Lawrence's.
Quite an old bike, this. I'd say it's maybe 20, 30 years old. But it has a seriously buckled rear wheel, so we're going to see if we can unbuckle it. Now, unbuckling wheels is a really challenging task. Sometimes you get one step forward and two steps back, but I think I'm making a bit of progress with this one.
And why do you volunteer for this, Pork? Of all the things to give your time to, why this?
My day job is a desk job, so just to get my hands dirty working on bikes is something I've loved doing for years, and that's why I like doing it. It's
practical. You actively love the idea that it's something away from the office environment.
Absolutely, it's practical work where you can get your hands dirty.
And you're a cyclist.
I'm a keen cyclist, yeah.
So what condition do the bikes come in at? Are you shocked? Or?
I think the guys have done a fairly good triage on the bikes that they select. So there are very few bikes in here that are really hopeless. I think that, you know, this one with a bit of work, it'd be possible to put it back on the road again. The challenge is always going to be, can we get it back on the road without having to put too much in terms of new parts into it? Like, the theme is upcycling, so we want to be reusing the parts rather than, I suppose, putting too much effort into putting new parts onto them.
So, Dennis, you're one of the volunteers here. Why this for you?
So I am volunteering on the basis of, we had an initiative called Good Grub for the last 18 months. So we have lots of connections in giving out fresh fruit and veg to Deish School families. So we have the connections with all the principals of Deish School. So rather than Brona trying to reinvent the wheel, I said, look, you know, I can put you in touch with the Ashling Project, St. Lawrence's School and so on. And that's what's really been happening.
Getting to deliver those bikes, that's a fun job.
Oh, it is, absolutely, because you're delivering excitement. I mean, last week, honestly, with the Ashling Project, I could have done that all day long, just watch the kids' reaction. They were great lads.
Okay, well, listen, let's go and get moving then and start heading towards the school and loading up the van.
Perfect.
Principal Shane Fitzgerald of St Lawrence's College in Loughlinstown was there to greet Evelyn when she arrived with the delivery of upcycled bikes.
Oh, I can't wait to take a look at them.
They've all been 100% refurbished by the team down at the bike hub. So this will be for a smaller, maybe a first year student, boy or girl. And you can see there's lights in every bike that they put on, and there's brand new bells and everything.
Oh, so, wow.
So it's all ready to go. And then this green one, wouldn't mind it myself if I could only pull it out. Jesus. Or Janie Max.
Very cool,
that's like an old-fashioned rally bike. And the beauty about how I think this will work, Shane, is that not only will the pupils use them, but when they bring them home and so on, they're probably family bikes. So, you know, they can be used by all.
Well, that particular bike came from an elderly couple whose son was away working. And they said, look, it's sitting there. Come and get it.
That was donated by them.
Yeah. They came down to talk to us and they said, can anybody come and get it? So we walked up and got it.
So two more to go.
That's
a mountain bike. Suspension and everything.
Well, what's interesting is we have some staff members here who are experts in mountain biking. So I think this is going to be well looked after.
Brilliant. I mean, it's as good as new.
Dennis, I just want to thank you and all the people involved in this initiative, because it bridges a divide that's evident in our community. We'll be able to make a real difference to our students, and not just in their education, but their quality of life. And that's what we're trying to aim here in St. Lawrence College.
The last one. You can see it's got, looks like 20 years at least, if not 25. The bell is ready to rock and roll. Well, look, they've even obviously put on new tyres onto it as well. I mean, in fairness, it's certainly ready to go.
This is the Rolls-Royce version of the bike, is it? Like,
well,
this is serious.
Go on, Dennis, you have to get up and show us it in action now.
Well, I don't know if I can do a wheelie, but I'll have a go.
Dennis, come back. Come back. It's not for you.
Evelyn O'Rourke, possibly losing one of the upcycled bikes that were delivered to St. Lawrence's College in Loughlinstown on This Morning's Today with Claire Byrne. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, Paddy Casey and his daughter Saoirse dropped into Studio 8 to talk to Catherine Thomas on this afternoon's Ray Darcy Show. And they sang a couple of songs from Paddy's new album, Turn This Ship Around. So this is Paddy Casey and his daughter Saoirse with This World Is Stranger.
There are some people say we've never been up to the moon, yeah. What difference does that make to me? If that thing has no gravity, or if it's old technology, it someone left for us to see. What difference does that really make to me? There are some people who say that governments tell lies. Now, big surprise. I mean, there's your first mistake. You trusted them in the first place, and promises they might make. I mean, for goodness sake, you didn't really think that they were going to try. Hold on, go grab your coat and shoes now. Hold on, wait till you hear the news now. Hold on, 'cause this world is stranger than you might believe. Hold on, you ain't seen nothing yet now. Hold on, and it's just as you. Hold on, now take a look around and you'll see. This world is stranger than you might believe. Now I think it's fun to be just a little paranoid, maybe just a little naive. You know I think it's lazy when people say you're crazy just 'cause you don't agree with their reality. And I think it's fun just to keep an open mind. Hold on, grab your coat and shoes now. Hold on, wait till you hear the news now. Hold on, 'cause this world is stranger than you might believe it. Hold on, you ain't seen nothing yet now. Hold on, and it's just as you suspected. Hold on, now take a look around and you will see. This world is stranger than you might believe.
This World is Stranger, as performed live in Studio 8 this afternoon by Paddy Casey and his daughter Saoirse for The Ray D'Arcy Show. And that's all I have for you on this edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Nilo Sheridan. Don't forget you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio player. And I'll be back with another Playback Daily at the same time tomorrow. Until then, thanks for listening and good luck.